Time for this week's Property Pulse with Easy Properties. And as always, we're joined by Andre Kleinants from Easy Properties. Andre, hello, welcome back.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having us again.
Yes. So, Andre, today we're talking about something completely different. We're talking about offer to purchase. So, what exactly is an offer to purchase? Actually, I've heard it so many times, you know, when you speak to agents, they say, no, I just got an offer to purchase or something like that. And I'm like, what does that mean?
Well, essentially, it is exactly what the name says. It is where a potential buyer is making an offer to purchase, which basically becomes the agreement of sale in order to buy a specific property. So, yeah, that's as simple as it is.
Okay. And am I bound to the contract when I actually sign it? I'm sure I am.
Indeed, indeed. There's several clauses in a contract that would bind both the buyer and or the seller. So hopefully we're gonna delve into it a little bit. But yes, you are bound. There is obviously a new phenomenon that essentially gets people to walk away from contracts, which is upheld by the local courts. But it is the strongest contract that you can actually sign. According to legislation, you cannot sign a you can conduct and get a loan via online and all those type of things, but documents are signed with the banks as well as our contracts are signed in wet ink, and that's still dictated so by law.
Okay, and what are the requirements to make an offer to purchase valid?
There are actually five very specific conditions that must be met in order to make an offer to purchase valid. The first is obviously the parties. It's got to clearly indicate who the parties are to the contract, buyer and seller, or if it's a legal representative. Then a description, a very clear description of the property so that they can make sure that they are transferring the correct property to the purchaser. The third one is obviously the property price. What are you going to offer them? And coinciding with that, it is then the method in which the purchase price and by when it will be paid. Last but not least, then we look at the commission. Well, that doesn't make it legal, but the point is there are several others that one needs to adhere to. There's suspensive conditions, but we'll deal with that hopefully a little bit later. To make the contract legal is lastly the signature that is required of all the parties. So it must be correctly signed, which means the purchasers as well as the sellers, and then accepted normally by the property practitioner.
Okay, and on the issue of suspensive conditions that you just mentioned, I was told that a COC or a certificate of compliance for electricity is a suspensive condition and that the sale is dead unless it was issued. Is this correct?
Ian, no. There are very specific suspensive conditions. So generally in an offer to purchase, a COC could be a restrictive condition, but it's not a suspensive condition. By the nature of a suspensive condition, if it does not happen, then the contract becomes null and void. Let me give you an example. So generally, there are two suspensive conditions in a contract for when it comes to buying a property. The first would be the fact that you would have to apply a bond. So it is very clear then that if you don't apply, the contract will be nullified. Or if you basically get declined by the banks, it normally contains a very specific clause that says if you decline by the banks, then the contract is null and void from that point forward. The second suspensive condition, always generally contained in the offer to purchase, is the one where you may have a property that still needs to be sold. Normally, it's got two ways it can go. a property sold but not yet registered, so the transfer hasn't happened. And secondly, it could be that, you know, you're buying this property with a precondition, a suspensive condition, that I need to sell my home. And if you don't, well, then the offer to purchase is again null and void. One can create suspensive conditions. I signed off a contract earlier today where a suspensive condition was brought in, where it basically clearly stated and said, the agreement is subject to the purchaser making use of their conveyance to attend to the transfer of the property, being, and then they nominated the actual attorney. Now, that becomes suspensive of nature, which means if the seller does not accept this, they would want to walk away. So, big difference between various restrictive clauses and then, you know, generally what is known as a suspensive condition. But to answer the question, a COC is not a suspensive condition.
Okay. And let's talk about a subject to sale property, Andre. What are the ins and outs to look out for?
I'm glad that you're asking that question. So, as mentioned, when it comes to the subject to sale, firstly, I've seen people make the grave mistake where they withhold the information. It is, in fact, subject to the sale, but purely because of the fact that they don't want to advise the agents, or it could have been linked. Remember, we often have multiple transactions that's linked. So for whatever the reason, and it could be as simple as the fact that they have another subject to sale already in place, and this competing offer will replace it, but you cannot replace it with another subject to offer. So they would withhold information, and then things go wrong, as they sometimes do. So if it was a question that they should have done it in a basis where the first section normally that deals with the property is sold but not registered. So they should have completed that section. So that's something that we have found. And then later on, it turns out the property is not sold, or that the purchaser has made a decision to just walk away. So whatever the reasons, but that can then, you know, have dire consequences, because the purchaser is then in default. So the second one that we spoke about earlier was the one that where the property still needs to be sold. That normally nominates a period and time, a description of the property, and the possible price that they are expecting. Now, this is where one needs to take heed. The most contracts make provision for an escape clause, where it says that we will continue to market the property. Obviously, if the other property doesn't sell, you know, that you can look at other offers. Should you then actually receive a competing offer, these clauses contained, and that is known, and I have mentioned this before, the dreaded 72-hour clause. Now, it's often completely misunderstood by some agents, and obviously then, you know, between buyers and sellers. Now, this clause is only applicable when the property still needs to be sold, not to any other circumstances. Secondly, the competing offer may not, as I've mentioned earlier, be it's got to be unconditional except for a bond. Now, when you basically have received that, you will notify the purchaser, and then once the bond has been granted, that's when the 72-hour clause kicks in, which means that they have 72 hours to either waive the clause containing that they have to sell their property entirely, okay? But that's now obviously on the provision as well that the banks will approve it. So it doesn't leave you a lot of time to make changes, and where the bank says, I'm quite happy and your risk profile and everything and affordability reflects that you can, in an actual fact, have both properties. So interesting. And often a serious bone of contention where you know, properties are lost, their dream home, lost by, you know, missing out on one single day. So one needs to understand these and, you know, be careful that you can exercise the options very clearly.
Okay, and Andre, am I allowed to do any alterations to the property before registration of the property in my name?
Ian, no. Most of the offer to purchases will contain a specific clause that says you are not allowed before transfer to make any alterations or changes without the prior consent of the seller. And that will be only at the seller's sole and absolute discretion. So, should the purchase and all occupants have vacated and all those type of things, then, you know, they can agree to it, but generally we do it as an addendum to the contract where they can then start. I sat with a scenario a few years ago where we had people who bought a property, turning it into student accommodation, and then they gutted the property. Eventually, it turned out that, you know, we had a bond and all those type of things and an agreement in writing, but it also does contain certain clauses, obviously, as you know, that if, you know, for some or other reason you are in default, you would have to take the property back to its original condition. Now, that restitution that we're talking about there happened in this instance. So they gutted the place. It cost nearly 300,000 rand to basically just get it back into the condition that it was.
Sure.
Where they decided to abandon and, you know, not to continue. But obviously then that led to legal action, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow. That sounds rough. Okay. So the other day in our conversation, you mentioned the risk of ownership. What exactly does this entail?
So the risk of ownership is an interesting concept. I love explaining it by drawing sort of a line in the sand. So the risk of ownership transfers when the registration of the property happens from the seller to the buyer. That is the transfer of the risk of ownership as well. Simple example. We have had clients, they buy a property, they move in. 5 days later, there's a pipe that bursts. And they basically contact us and say, the seller is liable. He must immediately make a plan because, you know, he needs to come and fix this. So that's a very good example of the risk of ownership transfers. There's other clauses, obviously, in the contract that says that the property must be maintained and all those type of things. And we know the horror stories that has had to some properties where people have moved out, they leave it empty for 2 to 3 months. That's when damage and, you know, all those type of things actually can happen. But alas, yes, it's exactly what it is. The risk of ownership transfers on the day of a change of ownership from the seller to the purchaser.
Okay, and then we mentioned COCs earlier. That's the Certificate of Compliance. What is actually required from me when I sell my home?
Okay, a very interesting question there, Ian. Generally, the COCs depends on which province that you are in, and that, you know, have different requirements. So I'm going to deal with Gauteng. So a normal COC will be your electrical compliance certificate, and that will be the ECC, as they call it. Then the gas installation will have a compliance certificate, as well as your electric fence. Now, interesting enough as well is that there's often a misconception about the electrical certificate. You know, you people move in, the stove's not working. So in actual fact, the electrician does not, when he issues the COC, have to. They normally check it, but the ECC, that compliance certificate, does not cover the stove. We have different clauses in a contract which basically says that all appliances must be in a working condition. So one can rely on that clause, but it's a common misconception that when an electrical certificate has been issued, that a stove must be in a working condition. So it's actually not so. Then we spoke about compliances in other areas. So you also have what is known as a plumbing certificate, but that's more in the coastal areas, obviously, because the high factors of rust. And then you may have a beetle borer certificate that is required. Again, not in Gauteng, but it's prevalent the Western Cape, all the coastal areas, you know, like KZN and so forth. Now, the last but not least is in fact the, and this one is quite a mouthful, and it does provide one with a lot of headaches as well, is in some of the areas they have implemented what is known as the Spluma Act. Now, that's the Spatial Planning and Land Use Management Act. Now, according to this, it basically just says, so, you know, depending on which side of the fence you sit, you may have different opinions. But this basically says that your dwelling and the plans at the local municipality has got to be exactly the same. Now, we've seen over the last 30 odd years, people have gone to town, they do a lot of alterations to properties and things like that, and they do not have approved plans for that. So that was in order to curb that, which means the plans that's held by council, and when they come and have a look at the property, must be exactly the same. Otherwise, you would have to actually acquire the plans.
That's very interesting. I was also told, Andre, that as the buyer, I can nominate my own attorney to do the transfer of the property onto my name. Is this correct or not?
Ian, it is preferably that the seller nominates. So generally speaking, there's actually three different attorneys involved in the selling and transferring of a property. So the first one would normally be your bond cancellation attorney, which is appointed by the bank to cancel the existing bond over the property. Now, then you have the transferring attorney, which means the seller instructs normally an attorney and a conveyancer to represent him and transfer the property from his name to the purchaser. So the third one is then the new bond, if there is one, from the purchaser's side. The bank will also appoint an attorney then in order, you know, to protect the bank's interest, to register the notice of lien and everything over the property, where they then do the bond registration. Okay. So often the bank may ask either the bond registration or the transferring attorney to also do the cancellation. But we've had instances where we actually have to deal with three different attorneys. To answer your question, it is advisable that the seller, because remember, it's his property, the attorney is representing him. If you change that and the purchaser is nominating an attorney, they can control the contract. And now that attorney is in actual fact representing the purchaser and not so much the interests of the seller, which could potentially have some dire consequences.
Okay. And Andre, what happens when the buyer doesn't want to proceed with the sale and just ghosts everyone? Any recourse?
Ian, most contracts make provision for proper legal compliance and that you can see them proverbially. But as I've mentioned earlier, this is not commonly upheld, you know, in our courts any longer. There seems to be a common opinion, or, you know, and obviously from a legal perspective, where if you sell the property and, you know, somebody walks away and you get to sell it again, they would ask you and say, but why do you want to earn double the commission? Now, that's an interesting debate, because the fact is it was long in the market. You had a lot more expenses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not an easy, well thought out sort of approach. But yes, we have successfully had recourse against a purchaser that ran away. You know, once they've signed a contract. Now, if you also look at these type of contracts, as I mentioned, in fact, if you state clearly that you are buying a property cash and you default, you are liable for commission. You are liable for whatever consequence, and normally that's contained in some of the clauses, and the damages suffered by the seller. Now, this could run up, depending on how far the cost was also incurred by the various attorneys, they can even recover that. So, yes, it has happened. That we can successfully claim, but not necessarily in all instances.
Okay. And then sometimes you get buyers and sellers fighting, some really bitter fights revolving around the fixtures and fittings in the property. Any advice for us when it comes to this, the do's and the don'ts, Andre?
Well, yes, let me start with the advice. Obviously, when it talks about fixtures and fittings, I generally use a clear, simple example. You know, when I have a coffee at Wimpy or Mug and Bean, you know, with clients and so forth, I love taking that, you know, those sachets of the, which comes in a bowl for the sugar. And yeah. I take them out and I'm saying, if I overturned this, whatever falls out, you can take with you. But anything else must remain. So why am I using such a simple example? We have had instances where people, you know, registration has happened. They maybe stay a bit longer in the property. Like in this particular instance, they then removed, they had very large TVs, and they removed all the brackets, only to leave behind, you know, an over-engineered job that left holes bigger than a one rent piece. You know, so four of those, as well as they had repainted the walls. And so there's three rooms with these big gaping holes and a square that's a completely different color.
Oh, no. Now,
you don't necessarily get exactly the same TV bracket. And it could have potential. So the first word of advice I generally say to people, those things are not that expensive. Rather leave them, okay? Let the buyer decide if they wanted to take it off. Now, guidance here would be as normally, if there are stuff that you really believe that, you know, you need to take with you. We've had instances where obviously family or friends or, you know, where it's extremely dear to people, where they've got incredible chandeliers or wall fit, lightning that was handmade. I've seen some stunning pieces, but then we basically made provision for that in terms of the contract where we said, this is excluded. This does not form part of the, the contract. And it's interesting. I mean, we've had people who have left the country. They've needed to start, you know, their jobs very quickly. There were certain inclusions. And in this instance, a trampoline, you know, it was a portable trampoline, which they had asked family to come and just clean and, you know, hand over the keys and so forth. And they decided, great. I'm so happy that they left a trampoline and they just took it. So, you know, we had to refer back to the contract, make sure the trampoline isn't returned because it was actually an inclusion in the contract. So, yeah, fixtures and fittings can become a serious bone of contention. But generally speaking, it is everything that actually forms part of the building that is of a permanent nature. If not, you should exclude it to make sure. It also includes things like a DSTV dish, you know, stuff like your alarm systems. When it comes to pools, you know, does it include the pool equipment, filters, motors, between different provinces even? And this is a very, very interesting one. Is the stove remaining or not? So there are provinces where you don't need to leave the stove. So, you know, but the agents are properly trained. They should know exactly what to put into a contract. But I'm just saying to listeners, listen, just understand it. Don't assume that the stove is remaining. Ask the question and make sure.
Yeah, that's the best way to do it. Andre, last but not least, the issue of commission. Why would one need a real estate agent? And maybe some would ask, why do they charge so much? That wasn't my question.
Was it not your question?
No, the last bit was not mine.
Okay, good. Happy to hear that. All right. So why would she need an agent? Now, I think it's very important for people to actually understand what it is that agents do. I think there's a complete misunderstanding. People think that these guys just put a few people in a car, follow up, take them there, sign the contract and earn commission. It is not so. There is a lot of very specific things that an agent actually gets paid for. One of them is negotiation, the negotiation skills. But I specifically, I want to talk about, I'm gonna touch on a few, but I also specifically would like to just point out, the qualification criteria and, the corporate governance and everything that is becoming more burdensome to the industry. Now, so I mentioned negotiation. So, I mean, you know, it's an art. People often ask me and they say, but, you know, are you guys actually in the sales industry or are you in the service industry? I've had some incredible salespeople, sales managers and things like that that failed horribly as an estate agent, purely because of the fact that they are not known for, you know, good service doing an end-to-end sort of type of follow-up and maintaining those relationships. And real salespeople are notorious also, obviously, in doing they're terrible with paperwork. Now, so selling a home involves a lot of paperwork, a tremendous amount. I mean, from legal compliance and all those type of things that, the guys have got to be schooled in. So remember, selling your home can be emotionally draining. So, I've heard this saying where they say, you've got to remember that an estate agent is not just an estate agent. You know, to some extent, he's a lawyer. People go through divorces and various things and whatnot. He has to be an industrial psychologist. Sometimes he's got to be it's expected of him to be an engineer, et cetera. So the reality is, yes, they do pick up a lot of different skills. It's important that people understand that. So, remember as well as that they work completely on risk. I'm going to touch on this a little bit. They don't require upfront fees. When you look at places in the UK, if we actually just compare in terms of how the way that they basically work there, you know, there you may only pay 1% or 2%. But people don't understand what happens. You know, there you've got to get your own attorney, known there obviously as a solicitor, but, you know, they do the contract. Pre-inspections, there they also have, a sort of an advertising fee. So the seller first pays for advertising and only then will they come and take photos and actually put it up for sale. Now, these are costs that in good faith, our real estate agents and companies absorb upfront. Now, it comes at a price. So, it's sometimes a very easy question. It's two things that I ask people. I'm saying is, whatever you do, you run a radio station. If somebody comes and says, listen, I want 50% discount, would you be inclined to say, okay, that's no problem? So generally all of us know, and I'm going to answer that on your behalf, is that we don't just get huge discounts, number one. Purely because of the fact that we all understand that, you know, there are budget costs, expenses, and so forth. So, that I think is an important factor to sort of keep in the back of your mind as well. Mm-hmm. Now, the other factor that I wanted to sort of just highlight is obviously, the especially when it looks at, let's talk about a lease agreements for, just for a moment as well. I mean, the agent is not just there to, handle the lease agreement. They are a mediator between two responsible parties. So often when there's problems, they need to deal with that. If defects are uncovered, let's talk about selling again. So, a defect is found. Who's the first person that they phone and blame? Is a real estate agent, generally speaking. Obviously the responsibility does not fall on that property practitioner, but you know, they have to go through the whole process. I mentioned earlier in one of the other sessions that was recorded about the property condition report to make sure that they adhere to all the legislative requirements. Now, when you start looking at, you know, this is a genuine profession. So, you know, the guys have got to actually register at the PPRA. You've got to pay a fee, same as an engineer and all those type of things, for 3 years in advance. Okay, so these are costs that they need to, you know, carry, and that they need to basically, well, what's the word I'm looking for, reinstate, which, you know, comes often at a quite a high price. Okay, so yes, estate agent fees are negotiable. Okay, the standard in South Africa is anything between 5% and 7.5%. Now, remember as well, most of our companies, unless it's a very small individual real estate agent that runs as a principal, but we are VAT registered. So firstly, you know, we act on behalf of SARS. So, you know, the fact is that you may have an agency that says, listen, we work at 2% or 3%. It's not that. They would generally actually add the VAT, because otherwise there's even less into it. How do they actually cover the costs, which is sometimes literally just a little bit impossible. Now, we also spoke about, as a matter of interest, you know, agents generally work longer hours than many other professions. So often ask people, I say, what do you think the average estate agent earns in South Africa? There's 41,000 estate agents in South Africa.
Yo.
21,000 of those are just in Gauteng alone.
Oh, my word.
What do you think is the average income for a real estate agent?
Oh, so now I must guess, hey?
Yeah.
Per month, hey? Is it per month?
Per month, yeah. Let's talk about per month.
Well, it obviously depends on how good they are, you know, and how much sales they've done. But, I'll just have to go with the ballpark figure and say 30K?
Well, in fact, the PPRA is published, and I must say, I think, and if you look at various other sources, I really do believe that it's actually far less than this. Mm. You know, they on average, they've published and they said that they earn about 19,000 rand a month.
Wow.
And we know out of experience that there are a lot of them that earn, you know, far less. So now you start looking at the cost factors that they need to cover. When you start doing an analysis, you break it down and you start looking at, you know, what people are literally going to basically eventually get. You know, the average agent in South Africa sells 7 houses a year. Okay. So now that literally means, depending after taxes and all those type of things, depending on their split with a company and so forth, traditional models. Let's say even if they on a tax directive of 18%, they probably get about 17,000 rand from a transaction where they've sold a property of 1 million rand at 5%. Okay, So they would get 17,000. Now just think about that. The average agent sells maybe 7 houses. Okay, that will then leave them roughly with 121,000. That's only 10,000 rand, 10,145 rand per month.
Wow.
Yeah. So that is important to take note of, because obviously, as I mentioned, I mean, they assume cost and risk to get your house sold. And then yet people want to still, you know, argue and really don't understand, I think, often what it is that this property professional is literally doing. Of course, from a commercial point of view, from you know, us as the brokers or the owners of businesses and so forth, you know, costs are extremely high. Just to give you an example, you advertise on Property 24 and Private Property, the largest two portals. You're in for about 25,000 to 35,000 rand a month.
Sure.
That's just one single medium.
Hectic.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, our cost base are incredibly high. So, yeah, I think it is important that people factor that in and that they literally just understand, you know, with websites, any like any other business, to maintain them and you know, to do search engine optimization and Google and everything. So I'm not even talking about the normal expenses like petrol and cell phone and all those type of things. Mm. Here's the fact. There's no guarantee that an agent will be successful when they sell a property. Okay. Sometimes you've got to sell it multiple times or you're not going to get it sold at all.
Yeah.
But with every one of those, they incur costs. So are there agents who do exceptionally well? Yes, they are. Discussion perhaps for another day. So yeah, I hope I answered at least you know, some of that.
Yeah, yes, you had a lot of very, very interesting stats there today, hey? 41,000 estate agents in South Africa and 21K of them up in Gauteng. That's crazy. Isn't it a very competitive business? Do you guys actually fight over properties?
Look, it's a very good question that, because yes, and here's the other problem is that with 21,000 of them sitting in Gauteng, now 50% of the total number of 41,000 registered agents in this country are literally candidate property practitioners. That's an intern. Mm. So, you know, there's been a lot of changes in terms of the educational requirements and so forth. But technically, one out of every two agents is literally an intern, which means they do not have the experience like, you know, any one of the other agents who have spent years honing their skills mm. and understanding it. And if I may, today I'll actually end off this with a very good descriptive joke, if I may.
Sure.
So this guy worked on a U-boat, right? So they've basically made the decision he's of age, he needs to retire, okay? So here you have this U-boat known for its temperament and sometimes some issues. So he left and then they contacted him and said, listen, we've used a variety of different mechanics and different things and we just don't know how to get this U-boat to, you know, to work. We've got gearbox problems. Anyway, long story short, and he came there, said to them that, you know, now I'm an independent consultant. I do charge a bit more. And they said, listen, we've got to get this thing, you know, going in the water. It's got to run. So yes, whatever your fees. So he walked in and then took out a huge hammer, aimed somewhere on the gearbox, gave it a good clunk, and then sent them, and there everything was fine. And then he sent them a bill for 25,000 rand. So they said, this is ludicrous. You come here with a hammer, you hit the thing once, and you charge us 25,000 rand. And well, basically, it came down to the point where he said, it's not so much about using the tools that I had at my disposal, it's knowing where to hit the gearbox.
Yes. Love
so
it.
So the same applies to a real estate agent. Getting the right person that has got all the experience, that has done a number of sales, will set you up for a very good experience. And pay them. You're actually employing them. And that's something that often people don't understand. If you want an agent to perform, employ him. Give him the sole mandate. Give him the time to sell and do his job properly.
Mm. I like it. Andre, you say you know where to hit that gearbox, eh?
I hope so, Ian.
I'm convinced after today that you really do. You know where to hit the gearbox, definitely. Andre Kleinans, CEO and founder of Easy Properties. Today's Property Pulse, or this week's Property Pulse, was very, very interesting. Thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure. Looking forward to it. See you next week.
Thank you. Same to you. Bye-bye.
Bye.